and military equipment might be used for internal repression in Egypt, and that Turkey's conduct in the Eastern Mediterranean Sea would run counter to the sovereignty of any EU member state. While some EU countries such as Germany, Finland and Denmark have adopted restrictions on the arms exports to Riyadh, Italy and other EU nations have ignored the resolution in full so far.
It's unacceptable that Egypt, a country known for human rights abuses, is the top importer of Italian weapons across the world. Saudi Arabia follows. We can't accept that countries involved in wars continue to receive our military equipment. Unfortunately, Italy hasn't done much since the EU Parliament adopted the resolution.
An Italian government report has found that the Unit for the Authorizations of Armament Materials green-lighted 57 times last year the supply of military systems, including bombs, torpedoes, rocket launchers and missiles, worth about 200 million euros to Saudi Arabia and UAE.
One in four arms sold worldwide in 2019 were produced in Europe, according to a report by CIPRI, the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute. France and Germany topped the list of European countries that trade in arms, while Italy came third.
We often look at the US as the main arms supplier worldwide. However, we forget that Europe also plays a major role. If the European Parliament only issues resolutions and not directives, all those countries not observing arms embargo cannot be sanctioned. Furthermore, there is a lack of political will among EU countries for change. European companies even compete with one another to sell more arms in conflicting countries.
Consecutive Italian governments have also ignored a domestic law passed in 1990 which bans the exports of weapons in countries in a state of war. Italy's arms exports stood at over 5 billion euros in 2019. Max Civili, Rome.
The United States presidential election continues to be unfinished and disputed. Democrat Joe Biden holds a slim lead, but President Donald Trump has significant public support from Republicans at the grassroots and elite levels to not concede. The election was preceded by months of controversy regarding the unprecedented use of mail-in ballots, which appeared to swing the election in the slight favor of Joe Biden at the last minute. A recent poll showed that a whopping 70% of Republicans do not believe the election was free and fair. Polls held just prior to the vote showed just half the number of Republican skeptics. Democrats say vote fraud has not yet been proven and that Trump must concede to prevent increasing distrust towards the nation's electoral process. But this is the third disputed election in the last six tries. Many are insisting that this election must be judicially vetted in order to prevent even more alienation, apathy, abstention, and anger. Others say the economic, social, and health disaster caused by the coronavirus makes this not the year to insist on transparency.
Six elections, that's my entire lifetime. So one in two of elections in my lifetime, and only I've been able to only vote in the last, I think, three of them. Or four of them. That says a lot about people's uncertainty of these elections, and that's just only going to grow if the system remains how it is.
The repeated electoral chaos is likely to undermine perpetual U.S. claims that their model of democracy is not only the best, but should be emulated around the world. Harvard ranked U.S. election integrity just 57th in the world. And that was last year.
This is not a model of a political system that would want to be mimicked. And it would only be mimicked if it's being used by the powerful. It would only be mimicked by them because they want something that undermines a majority view. And you should reject that entirely. If you really are for the small d democracy, if you're really for that, you would reject the American model of electing presidents.
The corporate-dominated U.S. mainstream media appears to have a united front that Biden won the election and that any legal challenges are frivolous. A significant percentage of over 70 million Trump voters don't appear to agree. Weeks of chaos and tensions appear certain as the Electoral College, the vote which actually decides the U.S. president, doesn't meet until December 14th. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Hezbollah leader Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said that indirect talks between Lebanon and Israel will continue over the maritime border demarcation, stressing that this does not mean it will lead to normalization. In a televised address to mark Lebanon's Martyr Day, Sayyid Nasrallah said the talks were instead meant to be technical and set limits so Lebanon can benefit from its natural resources.
Many have written that the maritime border negotiations would pave the way for normalization between Lebanon and Israel. This is empty talk. We will never be a part of any peace talks with Israel. We consider its existence to be cancerous and devilish, and this will never change.
Sayyid Nasrallah also commented on recent Israeli drills along the Lebanese borders, calling it a demonstration of strength the resistance has established. He said such exercises proved the Israeli army was in a difficult state, where it has shifted its activities from attacking to defending. Sayyid Nasrallah made it clear in his speech that Hezbollah has strong, lifelong powers that will help it overcome any Israeli maneuver against Lebanon and guarantee victory in the region. He also made similar remarks towards the U.S. administration. Commenting on the U.S. presidential elections, Sayyid Nasrallah said he was happy at President Donald Trump's, quote, humiliating downfall. However, he said America's foreign policy will stay in favor of Israel, despite a new administration. In regards to the recent U.S. sanctions against Lebanese officials, including Gibran Basil, Sayyid Nasrallah said the U.S. is seeking to cause political chaos in the country and remove the resistance force from the region. He stressed the plan was doomed to fail.
What gives a government like the American one, which commits all sorts of terrorism and corruption, the right to label our politicians as corrupt and sanction them? We need to act upon our sovereignty and stand up against those American policies.
Sayyid Nasrallah said the U.S. has failed its many attempts to pressure the resistance and turn the Lebanese people against Hezbollah through the war in Syria and the economic crisis in Lebanon.
These sanctions will do nothing. They will not affect internal relations or cause conflict in Lebanon. The U.S. has been trying for years to cause inner rivalry. It has tried to weaken the strongest component in Lebanon, which is the resistance. This U.S. failure is a victory for the resistance and the Lebanese people.
For his part, Sayyid Nasrallah praised Lebanese officials, including Minister Basil, for their courageous stance against the U.S. pressure, saying it was for the sake of the nation. Rana Alaeddin, Beirut.
Pakistan and Iran have moved forward to expand their bilateral cooperation in major fields. During Iranian Foreign Minister Javad Zarif's visit to Islamabad, both neighbors decided to expand their ties in the field of commerce, investment, regional connectivity, security, and people-to-people exchanges. The border management and geostrategic issues in the region linked with the security of both countries were at the center of the bilateral discussions. Iran has a long-standing concern over the back-and-forth movement of militants and smugglers at its shared porous border with Pakistan, something which also came under bilateral discussions.
We had a very good discussion on border cooperation, including border markets, as well as opening a new cross, a new border crossing in Rimdan Gebel between Iran and Pakistan, which will happen hopefully within a week or two.
Pakistan and Iran also share concern over the political uncertainty revolving around Afghan peace deal after the disputed presidential elections in the United States amid allegations of electoral fraud. It remains unclear on whether or not Joe Biden will withdraw all American troops from Afghanistan by May next year under a peace deal between the current U.S. administration and Afghan Taliban
in early this year.
The huge financial and military losses in the 19-year-long war compelled the White House to have a deal with the Taliban largely on the terms and condition of the militants, something which many in the U.S. believe is a surrender deal.
On Afghanistan, we have almost similar views. Iran wants peace and stability in Afghanistan, so do we. We have decided to have more frequent discussions on Afghan situation.
A
few weeks back, Donald Trump said that the U.S. forces are going to withdraw, even they will have the Christmas in America. They are that much in rush. But, you know, after the, Democratic government, when they come into power in January, so I think they have a fear of change in the policies. This is the most important subject which foreign minister of Iran and the Pakistani authorities discuss.
Pakistan and Iran also share concern over the hideouts of the Daesh militants in Afghanistan, which they fear may be harder to dismantle if the peace deal derails. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Insulting the Prophet is a manifestation of the dark, savage civilization of the West. November 11th, 2020.
One cartoonist has done a damn thing by insulting the Holy Prophet in the language of cartoons. The issue is not merely that an artist has done a deviant and corrupt act. It is not limited to that. Rather, there are certain hands behind this incident. What evidence do we have for this? The evidence is that we suddenly find the French president and the French government supporting this act, and other governments support them as well. Therefore, it is evident that there is a network behind this issue. The issue is not that French art has declined and that it has fallen into such an abyss. Rather, the issue is about the policy of a government that is supporting this action, manifested through a politician's support for it. You say that a person has been murdered. Very well, you can express your regret and sorrow at the murder of that person. But why do you publish such cartoons in places where everyone can see them, and why do you support them? This is a very bitter and indecent incident taking place at a governmental level.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want on me. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
The issue is not that a mere artist or cartoonist has committed this act. The previous time that this happened, we also witnessed that governmental and political personalities embarked on defending and supporting it. Well, such courses of action have been repeatedly adopted in European countries and in the US. The incidents related to insulting the Holy Quran and the Holy Prophet have frequently occurred in Western countries in both the U.S. and European countries, but such incidents cannot damage the honor, magnificence, and greatness of the Holy Prophet of Islam in the slightest manner. It is completely clear that the enlightened personality of the Messenger of Mercy cannot be damaged with these actions. By Allah's favor, this sun shines more brightly on a daily basis.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Get up. Good morning.
Good morning. Your captain speaking, and we are currently cruising over Iranian skies.
ایستگاه شهید بهشتی مسافرین گرامی خواهشمند از جهت تعیین مسیر به تابلوهای راهنما توجه فرمایید.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. How is everything?
Good morning, all.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day He appointed for a rising. To Thee belongs praise, for Thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
Hello, welcome to the debate. I'm Kabi Takwe. Sudan's information minister has said that the U.S. President Donald Trump wanted to use Sudan as an election card by pressuring it to normalize ties with the Israeli regime. This spells just one side of the story behind Sudan's normalization deal with Israel. What about other Arab countries? Were they also pressured by the U.S. into normalizing ties with Israel? What did they have to give up, and what did they get in return? And what about the rights of Palestinians? Whatever happened to that? Just some of the questions we'll be asking in this edition of the debate. First, let's bring in Ahmed Caballo. He was the person who actually interviewed the information minister to bring us that exclusive coverage and the revelation of the facts. So, Ahmed, tell us about the interview and, of course, what you discovered.
Yeah, to be honest, he gave a very frank interview, much more frank than I was anticipating, and he essentially admitted that Sudan was blackmailed into this decision. He said, from when the transitional government took power, they began negotiating with the US to delist Sudan as a state sponsor of terror. And from day one, they made it clear to the US it had nothing to do with Israel and nothing to do with normalizing ties with Israel. And the US allegedly agreed to those conditions. And it was just merely a couple of weeks before the election that Secretary of State Mike Pompeo changed his mind and said that no, it had to be the principal condition. And if they wanted the state sponsor of terror designation lifted, they had to normalize relations with Israel, which left the transitional government in a very tricky position because the economy was flatlining. The economic minister said that the economy wouldn't last 7 months. So they had to assess their options, and they thought, shall we gamble on the Joe Biden administration And then if they gamble on a Joe Biden administration, the problem is that it'll take another 7 months coming with a fact-finding mission, and they might reach the same conclusion. So they were forced to accept a decision that they did not want to, due to the economic pressure in Sudan, due to the long queues for fuel, for bread, and the economic crisis that's currently riddling the country.
So basically from what you're saying is the fact that you had Mike Pompeo that came and gave a different type of approach to the whole scenario, of which I'm assuming that is where you have used the word blackmail, which is indeed what actually transpired based on the way that Pompeo made his request from Sudan. Is that a correct way of looking at it?
Yes, and I asked the minister if he felt that the United States were using the economic situation in Sudan to leverage Sudan to normalize relations with Israel. Now, he gave a diplomatic answer, but if you read between the lines, he essentially admitted that yes, they knew we were struggling, they knew we had no other options, and they knew that we were going to accept this deal because there was nowhere else for our economy to go.
Okay, very well. Let me now bring in our guests to discuss this a little bit further. Journalist and activist Khaled Barakat joins us from Vancouver. Khaled Barakat, welcome. Our reporter there, Ahmed Kabaya, who traveled to Sudan and gave us that interview, of which we came up with this revelation now, which is the topic of our debate, amongst other issues that we're going to discuss. First, let me get a reaction from you of how you think that the U.S. actually used or pressured Sudan into this, of which, as our reporter said, Michael Pompeo, to actually to move forward in a blackmail-type scenario in order to get the normalization deal out of Sudan with Israel.
That is an excellent question, and I think that the U.S. always put pressure on states in order to normalize relationship with Israel. It's not just Sudan. In this case, we know more information because of this interview and also other reports that have indicated clearly that Sudan was pressured into this relationship with Israel. But even some of the Arab reactionary regimes, but they are pressured in a different way. Still, that, you know, they're trying to spread the fear in the Arab world that Israel will protect you from Iran, which is a false statement, and also trying to prove or, you know, tell all states in the area that the only way to you to get to the White House and a normal relationship with the U.S., you have to go through Tel Aviv. Basically, if you want to normalize your relationship with the U.S., you have to go through Israel as their allies in the region. Pressure always have been used, sometimes economic pressure, sometimes political pressure. And one of these ways, is especially with illegitimate regimes and governments, that, you know, this card, the U.S. could use it anytime. We know that today, for example, Israel have military bases in Africa, in some of the islands along the Red Sea, and this also exerts military pressure. Some of its nuclear submarines are roaming in the Mediterranean and in the Red Sea. So all of these factors are, you know, just normal understanding and general wisdom of the people of the area. If it's up to people and even states, if it's up to them, you know, they will not normalize with Israel.
Ahmed Kabaya, you know, when we take a look at the situation in Sudan, prior to that, of course, you had its former president that was there, but, you know, there was a point way back when Sudan had pretty much adamantly stated that it will not have any relationship with Israel, that it would not normalize ties with Israel, and this obviously requires a history check. At what point did the U.S., and I'm guessing along with Israel, feel like there was now an opportunity in order to move forward and make this request or demand, or should I say blackmail, Sudan into this? I mean, could you give us a little bit of a rundown there if you can?
That's a great question. In my analysis, it was when the Saudi UAE faction of the military dictatorship took over. So within the military apparatus, there is a split between the Muslim Brotherhood aligned factions and the Saudi UAE aligned factions. And what happened when Umar al-Bashir was overthrown in April was that Hemeti and Burhan, who were aligned to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, they took control of the military and became the most powerful men in the country. And when that happened, it became clear that normalizing with Israel was again on the cards, because Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, of course, more keen with relations with Israel than, say, the Brotherhood bloc. And that is when they saw this opportunity. So it was also the fact that Sudan has been considered a pariah state for a long time. And the only way to get access to Washington, as my colleague just mentioned, was to prove to Washington that it now was a reliable client state. And by normalizing relations with Israel, it proves to Washington that Sudan can once again be trusted as a source of influence in the region. Because before that, if we remember, in the 90s, Omar al-Bashir had very close relations, or relations, with the Islamic Republic of Iran. And now it's quite clear that it's distanced itself from the Islamic Republic of Iran and is very much in the Saudi-Emirati axis.
Okay. Well, Khalid Barakat, we know that this deal has come weeks after the similar moves that were made by the United Arab Emirates and also Persian Gulf island of Bahrain. The two have become now the first to recognize Israel in 26 years. Tell us whether you think what type of pressure was exerted on them to come out and make the announcement and to formalize this, even though, of course, it's been said that they have had a relationship with Israel behind the scenes.
Well, in principle, there is a camp that is led by the United States and Israel and the Arab reactionary regimes, especially regimes like Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, and others. And we need to remember that this camp have an alliance that goes back way back, even to 2012. In a real way, but there is always a secret doors and relationships between these regimes and Israel. Every couple of months, we see a new report that date back these relationships to even after 1967 war. We have to remember that after the 1967 occupation and aggression that Israel launched, Sudan, for example, was the capital that declared no reconciliation, no recognition, and no relationship with Israel. And so for them, Sudan is kind of more of a sentimental, more of a relationship than United Arab Emirates and Bahrain. And later on, you know, down the line, the Saudis are going to come along also and normalize relationship. But Saudi Arabia, that's the big chunk in the piece that Israel is looking at. And the most important thing to remember is that this kind of policies, it is used on the basis of the carrot and the stick. So either, you know, these regimes are getting the carrots or they are get the stick. And basically because they don't have any sense of legitimacy in the country. So, for example, they cannot do that with Tunisia, for example, because we have an elected president in Tunisia, we have a public opinion, very strong political movement, anti-normalization in Tunisia. So they will not be able to pressure Tunisia because it has a democratic institution. But these Arab regimes, they lack these legitimacy. They depend very much on the protection of the United States and now Israel.
Very well. Let me bring in Michael Lane now. He's a political analyst who joins us from Washington, D.C., to bring him into the conversation. Michael Lane, welcome. So let me first get a reaction from you. We have gotten information firsthand that Sudan's information minister has said that the U.S. President Donald Trump wanted to use Sudan as an election card by pressuring it to normalize ties with Israel. Your reaction to that?
Well, it's not surprising. I mean, when you look at the timing of these successes, it was something that the Trump administration had been working toward for a number of years. It was part of their strategy to follow down this route. But when you had three countries all of whom decided they were going to play this card and normalize relationships with Israel in the just several months, and in some cases only weeks leading up to the election. It was something that the Trump administration worked very, very hard on the timing and getting them to fall before the election rather than after the election. I wouldn't be surprised to hear widespread reports at some time that the Trump administration was pressuring any number of countries to take this step before the election.
When you talk about the U.S. placing pressure, i.e. Donald Trump placing that pressure perhaps, then you know, there could be an observation on that, that there's an or else, meaning a precondition. For example, do you think that there was a precondition set here, as our reporter indicated, through the Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, who said that if you want to be taken off the terror list, you have to make this formal, the normalization with Israel? Do you think that that was the case?
You know, there are a number of techniques and tools that the United States would use, the Trump administration or any administration for that matter, the State Department, that they would use in dealing with our both our allies, our friends, and our adversaries in terms of influencing them to do things that we would like to see influenced. So, you know, would it be an exact quid pro quo, if you do A, then we will do or allow B? It wouldn't surprise me if that was used in many circumstances. I can't confirm that it was used in these circumstances. We simply don't know. On the other hand, it might be more general talk about, okay, well, you know, we provide so much in foreign aid to y'all, and, you know, if you would like to see that foreign aid continue at that level or even increase, then we would like to see some cooperation on some things that are important to us. On the other hand, if you can't see your way clear to cooperating on this one particular issue that's important to us, we can't guarantee that Congress will continue to do the foreign aid funding at the same level that it has. Some of the threats can be more direct and more overt than others. Sometimes they can be extraordinarily subtle, but the message still gets across that we are friends, we share a similar point of view. This is one of the things on which we really want you to share our point of view, and there will be rewards, there are carrots and or sticks as we go through, depending on how much of our point of view you share.
Okay, let's talk about the stick. That's important. Khalid Barakat. I mean, when we take a look at the way that the U.S. may have pressured countries like Sudan, like the Persian Gulf island of Bahrain, or with the UAE, how far do you think the U.S. actually pressured them into coming out, making sure that this is something that needs to be out in the open, this so-called normalization with Israel? I mean, do you think that the U.S. exerted a lot of pressure on them in order for this to, again, be out in the open? And also at the same time, I know it's two questions in one, we have to talk about the Palestinian concern here, the topic of Palestine. It doesn't seem to be the number one priority when it comes to the so-called normalization of ties when it comes to these countries.
Well, we have to remember that the mere existence of these regimes depends on the protection of the United States, and now the United States and Israel. We also need to remember that these regimes are not really reflecting the will and the sentiment and the position of the people in the country. We know, for example, the regime of Bahrain. This is a regime that absolutely lacks all forms of legitimacy in Bahrain. The people of Bahrain, the vast majority of the people of Bahrain, has been engaged in peaceful demonstrations and uprising, and they have been brutalized by this regime. And so the you know, ruling class of Bahrain wants to protect its interest and its wealth by associating itself with the United States and Israel now, because it's closer. Also, it allures them the fact that the Palestinians are not in their best shape, and that Palestinians are weak, and they look at the Palestinian angle and they see that there will be no reaction, real reaction by Palestinian leadership and Palestinian factions. and therefore nothing will deter these regimes from going into more and more public relationship with Israel. And this is not really normalizing relationship with Israel. This is really building an alliance between, you know, the Zionist colonization state of Israel and these reactionary Arab regimes. One of the things that we need to remember that the Palestinian factor here is a determining factor if Palestinians get their internal affairs in place and, they take a real and loud position. That will, in my view, deter these Arab reactionary regimes. Nothing else will do. They're not, a democratic governments. They're not governments that represent the will of the people, and therefore, why would they listen to Palestinians if they're not listening to the people of Bahrain? 95% of the people of Bahrain said no to normalization. This is the vast majority of the people of Bahrain. And that goes the same in Saudi Arabia and Emirates. If you will conduct a real poll amongst the people right. of the region, you know, they are against this relationship with Israel.
Okay, so Michael Lane, the Palestinian issue, can you please tell us how the U.S. is approaching that in terms of the rank and the importance that it has when it comes out to these countries that are saying that it has to come out and normalize ties with Israel? I mean, is it trying to tell Palestinians, we're just going to have countries come on board, whether you like it or not, they're announcing their normalization with Israel, and therefore you have to, for example, succumb to the terms of this so-called deal of the century, which at this point is now kind of it's at a critical juncture because you have possibly an outgoing President Trump along with his son-in-law Jared Kushner. But do you think that that's the approach that the U.S. is using in order to convince the Palestinians that you don't have a choice now because these countries are coming on board?
I think so, yes, if I understand the question. Look, Trump, when he announced the deal of the century and then sort of moved forward with it, had the U.S. embassy move to Jerusalem, et cetera, was still trying to get Palestinian President Abbas on the phone. And Abbas hadn't talked to him for months, perhaps as much as 2 years. I forget the exact timing on this. And when that whole thing was started and Abbas was still refusing to discuss anything with President Trump or with his representatives, the president finally said, okay, well, we're moving ahead with this. This is what we're doing. And I'm going to leave a window open here. The window is 4 years for the Palestinians to decide if they want to come back, talk with us about what they think this agreement should look like. And there was still the door open for some modifications in it. Although once it was announced and once it has passed a year, those modifications become extremely difficult
okay.
To make.
I'm sorry, I got to interrupt you. I got to jump in here, Michael, and I do apologize. I'm going to bring in Khaled Barakat with the final question in less than a minute, if you can, Khaled Barakat. Our guest there neglects to say that Israel in the past 4 years has continued with its violations of the Palestinian territories, even though the normalization of ties with the UAE, it said that it was going to freeze at least the settlement expansion, but it didn't. Do you think that right now with an outgoing U.S. president that this so-called deal of the century is going to fall flat and not go anywhere? Less than a minute.
Well, I mean, Biden is committed to keep the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem. There is not going to be a lot of changes between Biden and Trump in essence. In real essence, there will be a different language used, absolutely. I know that the Palestinian Authority for sure are, clapping for Biden and they're happy about Biden that Trump is gone now. But I don't think that any real substantial changes that Biden will bring to Palestinians.
Okay.
The only way for Palestinians to move forward is to have an alternative Palestinian revolutionary path.
Very well. We're going to have to end it there. Thank you very much. Let me thank our reporter at the top of the hour, the debate, Ahmed Kabayo, who spoke to us, who brought us that exclusive interview. Thank you so much, Ahmed. Also, political analyst Michael Lane spoke to us from Washington, D.C., and journalist and activist Khaled Barkat, who spoke to us from Vancouver. That is for this edition of the debate. For Mikhail Tatwe, the entire team is goodbye. Until next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Mike Pompeo's visit, a first for a U.S. Secretary of State, will legitimize Israeli regime settlements, despite international consensus over their illegality, warns Prime Minister Shataye. The visit is a way to legitimize the settlements that will create a dangerous precedent that violates international law, Shataye said on Friday, November 13th, as quoted by the Palestinian state news agency Wafa. "We have prepared an article for you in this regard, written by the staff of Middle East Eye. This article is published under the heading, Dangerous Precedent, Palestinian Premier Warns Pompeo Over Settlement Visit. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please." Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammad Shataye slammed U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo's plan to visit illegal Israeli regime settlements in the occupied West Bank and Syrian Golan Heights, saying it will set a dangerous precedent. Pompeo would become the first State Department head to visit one of Israeli regime settlements, which are considered illegal by most of international community. The visit is a way to legitimize the settlements that will create a dangerous precedent that violates international law, Shataye said on Friday, November 13th, as quoted by the Palestinian state news agency Wafa. Palestine Liberation Organization Executive Committee member Hanan Ashrawi and the PLO Department of Public Diplomacy and Policy, which he heads, have also condemned Pompeo's plans in posts to Twitter. after overseeing a shift in U.S. policy to full complicity in Israeli war crimes, outgoing Pompeo will visit an illegal Israeli settlement built on a stolen Palestinian land in Al-Biraya city near Ramallah in a bid to advance his personal political plans, the department tweeted. Hussein al-Sheikh, a member of the Palestinian Fatah Movement Central Committee, tweeted recently that Pompeo's planned visit to settlements is a challenge to international legitimacy. The visit represents a challenge to the positions of all previous American administrations, which emphasized the illegality of Israeli settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories, he wrote. Pompeo's visit to the occupied Palestine comes exactly 1 year after he said the U.S. did not consider the Israeli regime settlements on occupied Palestinian land to be illegal, putting Washington at odds with U.N. Security Council resolutions. The Zionist regime unilaterally annexed the Golan Heights in 1981 and aimed to annex the West Bank in July, before postponing the plan amid U.S.-led normalization deals with the UAE and Bahrain. Pompeo is expected to visit the West Bank, which announced earlier this year that it had rolled out a label named after him in a show of appreciation for his pro-settlement work. Last year, the United States unsuccessfully challenged a European decision to put a label on all products that come from West Bank settlements. The U.S. State Department has not confirmed Pompeo's itinerary. In a statement earlier this week, the department said only that he would visit the occupied Palestine and meet with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in a regional tour. Our own David Miller, a veteran U.S. diplomat in the West Asia region, tweeted that Pompeo's visit isn't about Trump or Bibi's politics. It's about Pompeo and 2024, referring to Netanyahu by his nickname. Pompeo has made little secret of his aspirations for higher office and has frequently pointed to his support of Israeli regime, a major cause for his Republican Party's evangelical Christian base. Next week's trip would be one of many precedent-breaking moves made by Pompeo and Donald Trump's White House. In March 2019, Trump signed an executive order recognizing the Zionist regime's control over the Golan Heights, citing a critical strategic and security importance to occupied Palestine. The next month, Netanyahu announced plans to establish a new Israeli regime settlement in Golan Heights, named after Trump, called Trump Heights. In November that same year, the Trump administration said that it no longer considered Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank to violate international law, going against a broad diplomatic consensus. Prior to this year's presidential election, Pompeo addressed the Republican National Convention from Al-Quds, which his administration recognized as the capital of Israeli regime in 2017. Pompeo drew outrage from the Democratic Party, which lambasted him for using diplomacy for political advantage. About 450,000 Israeli settlers live in the occupied West Bank with access to more land than its 2.8 million Palestinian residents.
Good morning.
Of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.